May it please the court. My name is Lori Ordaway, and I am honored to be here before this panel, and may it please counsel for the state. I'm here today to represent my client, Mr. Edward Venegas, and I had four issues in my brief on Mr. Venegas' behalf. I will rest on my brief on the sufficiency issues, unless, of course, the court has any questions. Otherwise, I will turn to the two evidentiary issues that I raised in my brief, actually the two trial error issues. The first is that the trial court abused its discretion in denying a motion for continuance that my client made on the date of trial, admittedly, but before voir dire had begun. And I acknowledged in my brief, as I will right off the bat here before this court, that we're asking the court to address this in the interest of justice. This was not a written motion. This was a verbal motion. But we feel like the test set out for reviewing this type of motion was met in this case. I'd like to just say parenthetically that the case Renteria that the state cited did concern a motion for a continuance, but it was a motion for continuance for counsel to investigate, not a motion for the defendant to obtain counsel of his own choosing. Regardless, the standard is correct. I understand the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And we urge that in this case, the trial court did, in fact, abuse its discretion. The Sixth Amendment and Article 1, Section 10 of the Texas Constitution provide an accused in a criminal prosecution with the right to counsel of his choosing. And we recognize that that right's not absolute and that it has to be balanced with the trial court's need for prompt and efficient administration of justice. And then, as I set out in my brief, the case of Ex parte Windham kind of sets forth the balancing test that should be done on review. I'll note that another case cited by the state, Parker versus State from the Court of Criminal Appeals, is distinguishable. Again, that was an abuse of discretion, and the court held that there was not an abuse of discretion in denying the continuance, but that was after the continuance is made after examination of the jury panel. And in our case, again, this motion was made before voir dire had begun. In any event, the factors in Windham are set forth. There are nine of them. And, of course, they are length of delay and whether other continuances were requested, the length of time that counsel had to prepare, the counsel that was appointed, whether another competent attorney was prepared to try the case, the balanced convenience or inconvenience to the parties, the court, and to counsel, and whether the delay was for legitimate or contrived reasons, and whether the case was complex or whether it was simple. And the last two, the prejudice prongs, I would say, whether denial of the motion resulted in some identifiable harm to the defendant and the quality of legal representation that was provided. And as I did in my brief, I think if you go through these factors, that the conclusion has to be that the trial court abused its discretion. The first one, although the length of the delay requested, it was not clear because the trial court pretty summarily denied the motion. But appellant was simply asking for time to retain counsel of his own choosing. And the record does not show, secondly, that any continuances had previously been requested or granted. And the trial court in this case pointed out that there was a pass slip signed on July 3rd, 2008, which set the case for October 6, 2008, which was the date the trial began. But there's a complete absence of motions filed, file marked in the clerk's record between those two dates. In fact, most of the motions that I found that are in the clerk's record actually reflect a file mark of October 9th, 2008, which was the date of sentencing in this case. So even though appointed counsel may have had 3 months from that July 8th date, we'd urge that the record doesn't show that he actually utilized that time. Fourth, the record doesn't reveal whether, admittedly, whether there was another competent attorney prepared to try the case. The fifth, the record doesn't reflect really the convenience or inconvenience other than the court saying, you know, we're set for trial today, your motion's too late, it's denied. But six, importantly, it was clear it was a legitimate motion. It wasn't a delay tactic. The appellant wanted to retain a counsel of his own choosing.
Well, why had he not had 3 months to do so?
Well, I can't speak to that because it's not on the record, Your Honor, and I'm not aware, but I know that if it's not on the record, it's not before this court. But I think that, conversely, counsel that was appointed for him had 3 months, and it's unclear what, if anything, counsel that was appointed for him did during that time.
Well, that kind of sounds like you're going down the road of ineffective assistance of counsel as opposed to what we're doing here.
But I'm not. And the test for whether he was entitled to counsel of his own choosing does not require me to show that the counsel that was appointed for him was ineffective. And I'm not attempting to show that. I'm just attempting to urge the court to consider that he had a right under the Constitution's to choose to have counsel of his own choosing. And I recognize Your Honor's question that he could have done that beforehand, but without knowing exactly what went on and what preceded that date of trial, I can't really answer that in an informed way, other than to say, yes, that's the day he made the motion, and there was no showing that it would have inconvenienced or unduly delayed the court to have granted that motion and granted him that right.
Was Mr. Venegas trying to seek his own privately retained counsel?
That's what the record reflects, okay, Your Honor.
Because you do agree that if it's appointed counsel, there's somewhat less of an opportunity to completely select your own counsel?
I do agree with that. And I guess I would like to turn to the state cited to Your Honor's opinion in Trammell versus State and suggested that and quoted the language that it would seem counterproductive for an indigent defendant to represent to the court that he has managed to secure pro bono counsel. But in that case, as Your Honor is quite aware, the defendant was seeking to add pro bono in addition to appointed counsel. What Mr. Venegas was trying to do was simply, substitute his own retained counsel of his choice for the attorney that had been appointed by the court. Just turning to the last couple of prongs of this test, the seventh one, I guess I didn't get to address that the trial was not particularly complex. It was a three-day trial, so that couldn't categorize it as either complex or simple, but I would say that I don't think that it came down against giving Mr. Venegas an additional time period in which to retain counsel of his own choosing. And most importantly, the eighth and ninth factors of the Windham test. The last minute filing of the motions by appointed counsel, and the fact that the appellant mentioned that counsel had met with him once the week preceding the trial, show the lack of preparation and the harm to the appellant, and affected the quality of the representation that he got. So we would urge that on balance of the nine factors enunciated, which are a non-exclusive list, but certainly I think give the court the entire view of the representation and the appellant's claim in light of it, show that he was entitled to exercise his constitutional right to secure counsel of his own choosing, and we would urge the court to review the entirety of the record on that and reverse and remand based on that reversible error. And I'll turn to my fourth issue, which is the second and last issue I'll address here today, and that is the admission of the testimony from the CPS investigator regarding Mr. Venegas' statement to him when Mr. Venegas was in custody. And the record will show that the investigator did not tell Mr. Venegas that he did not have to talk to him, and or that his statements could be used against him in court. Also, in this case, there was an officer present. The record's very clear on that. The court is very well aware of the Fifth Amendment in the Constitution protecting against self-incrimination and the safeguards that are enacted to protect against coercive custodial interrogation. And as I've cited in my brief, I understand that CPS, although a state agent, is of course not necessarily a state agent for purposes of law enforcement. But as set out in the Wilkerson case and the Berry case, which are both in my brief, when a CPS investigator is working or acting in tandem with law enforcement for the process of investigating and gathering evidence for criminal prosecution, then Miranda warnings are required. And I also noted when preparing today that two of the three members of this court were on the Court of Appeals in Wilkerson, and I understand, and that decision was reversed by the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so I imagine this court, as it is in all cases, would be very careful before reversing on this basis. But I would just urge that this case is distinguishable from Wilkinson and Berry, the subsequent case. And the main reason it's distinguishable is because there was a police officer sitting there in the room when the CPS investigator was interviewing my client.
Was that police officer called at trial to testify to anything?
No, I do not believe so, Your Honor. I'll check and then on rebuttal follow up on that. The Wilkerson test is a three-pronged test that Judge Cochran set out in great detail, and as this court knows, it first looks at the relationship between the state agent and, in this case, the CPS investigator and the police, and secondly, it looks at the interviewer's actions and perceptions, i.e., the CPS investigator in this case, and finally, it looks at the defendant's perceptions of the encounter. And I've gone through the analysis. I think that the first one, although it certainly wasn't explicit that the investigator was a state agent, I think it certainly was implicit, and the investigator got got information that the state used and that was hugely critical in their case against my client. Secondly, even if the interviewer perhaps it's not shown objectively on the record that the interviewer perceived this to be an interview for law enforcement purposes, that's certainly what culminated from that interview. Most importantly, from our perspective, is that the defendant's perception. A reasonable person in his position would have believed that this CPS investigator was there as an agent of law enforcement, particularly with a police officer sitting outside or sitting in the room. So we just submit to this court, please look at the circumstances again of the statement, and if you look at it, that this record shows that the CPS investigator was working in tandem with law enforcement and acted as an instrumentality or a conduit of law enforcement in this case.
And you base that just on the fact that the investigator was still within the interview room?
Yes, Your Honor. and the defendant's perceptions of that.
Ms. Hardaway, where did this interview with the CPR agent, where did that take place?
At the jail, Your Honor.
It was in.
At the police department, I would imagine. I'd have to double check, but that's what I would imagine. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ordway. Ms. Simmons.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrea Simmons, and I'm here today representing the state of Texas on behalf of Denton County in this case. Today, I would like to address the two issues that were raised by opposing counsel, the first one regarding the motion for continuance, and secondly, the CPS workers' testimony. The state would first urge that the motion for continuance was not a sworn, written document filed before this court, and therefore, according to case law, the issue was not preserved for appellate review. Alternatively, if this court were to discuss or rule upon the merits of the motion for continuance despite the preservation issue, the state would continue to argue that appellant had been found indigent by the trial court and had been appointed counsel. Counsel and appellant were aware of the trial date 3 months prior to trial in this case. And then on the morning of voir dire, prior to voir dire, but on the same morning, appellant himself, not through his attorney, but through himself, spoke to the trial court and said he'd like a little more time to retain his own counsel. At that point, prior to that point, and at that point, not only did he not have a counsel retained or any indication that he had sought to retain any counsel, he had no names, there was no counsel present to represent him in the matter. Furthermore, he did not present any evidence as to why he was suddenly financially able to retain his own attorney after he had been incarcerated for 3 months. So therefore, even on the merits of the claim, if this court were to do so, the state would argue that the trial court did not abuse its discretion by denying appellant's motion for continuance and continuing to trial. As to the trial court's admission of the CPS workers' testimony in this case, the facts of this case was a drug buy bust where it was basically set up for the police department set up with a confidential informant to set up a drug bust, and the defendant or appellant, Mr. Venegas, appeared at the Walmart to do the drug bust, to do the drug buy he was selling. And after the rest, when they went to secure his vehicle, they found two other individuals who were adults and then a 2-year-old child in the car. The 2-year-old child is the reason why CPS was called into this case, is because during a drug bust, a child was present. CPS was contacted by Denton County Police and did speak to Mr. Venegas regarding why his son was with him and to determine where that child should be placed next. During the discussion with Mr. Venegas, the CPS worker identified themselves as a CPS worker, said that they were there for the child. Why was the child with you? He stated that his mother actually keeps the child. He had only picked the child up for a short time, and during that short time, he also had this drug deal to do, and he never thought he was going to get caught. This was not a police interrogation or an interrogation by the CPS worker working as an agent of law enforcement. The CPS worker was merely there to figure out what to do with the child, and during the conversation with Mr. Venegas found out there was already an open case with Dallas County CPS. So the conversation with Mr. Venegas ended at that point, and he was informed by CPS that they would transfer the child to Dallas County to let them handle the situation.
Mr. Simmons, says on the brief, page 23, that the interview was at the Denton County Jail.
I believe the record indicates that it was at the Denton County Jail, and if my memory is correct, it was in an arraignment room, perhaps?
But at the jail.
At the Denton County Jail.
And there's not any dispute that the defendant was in custody at the time, is there?
There is no dispute.
And that the police officer was present during the time that the defendant was interviewed by the CPS official.
There was some type of an officer present in the room. the details on the record are unclear as to what kind of an officer this was. They asked, I believe the defendant's counsel asked the CPS worker, is it one of the investigation officers? And he said, it could have been, I'm not sure. So whether it's an investigation officer or a Denton County Sheriff's officer or a jailer at the Denton County Jail, the record is really unclear. And the CPS worker, the only thing the record does indicate that's clear about this officer is that he separated himself from him. He was in no way involved in the conversation with Mr. Venegas. He directed no questions to the CPS worker or appellant. He separated himself and was there solely, according to the CPS person, as protection, because defendant was an inmate at that time, and he was speaking with somebody from the community. They had an officer there for protection purposes.
This officer who was there, did he have a pistol on? Do you know?
There's nothing in the record to indicate whatsoever who this officer was, what his role was. I'm assuming he was uniformed for them to identify him as an officer. His testimony was never offered in this case. There's no report filed by the officer. I mean, as far as I know, we have absolutely nothing from this officer, and I have no clue who he was.
Thank you.
And because the CPS worker is a state agent, he is a state agent. However, he's not a state agent of law enforcement. He was not working in tandem with law enforcement in this case. And when they are working,
can we just look to the questioning to determine whether he's working in tandem with the
look to the question
officers or not?
Look to the questioning of
proofs in the pudding. If he's asking, where did you get the drugs, how many drugs were there, where did you hide them, who was your informant, where were you going to deliver them from, that's one thing. And if he's asking, where was the child that day, that's a different thing.
Absolutely, Justice McCoy. Absolutely.
Well, is there case law to support that, what seems to be common sense thought?
I don't have any common sense law in my brief, and oftentimes common sense law is the hardest law for me to find, it appears. But you would assume that there's law, and if not, there's always that inference there that based on the conversation that the officer or the CPS worker was not working with police officers.
Okay. Maybe opposing counsel will know of some common sense law.
I'm going to rely on her. But Justice Livingston, also, I did want to point out the police officer was not called in this case, and as I said, we had no information from that officer. In summation, if the court has no further questions, the state would just argue that the motion for continuance issue was not preserved for error. The CPS worker was, although a state agent, not a state agent working with law enforcement officials, and would request that the conviction and sentence in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Simmons. Ms. Ordaway, rebuttal.
May it please the court again. I just simply would say on our third issue regarding the denial of the motion for continuance, as I got up here and candidly said before, we understand the preservation issue, but would just ask this court to address this issue in the interest of justice because of the fundamental right that the defendant was trying to exercise in this case. And then turning to the court's questions and the state's argument on our fourth issue regarding the CPS investigator, I don't know of any other common sense law, Justice McCoy, other than the Wilkerson case and the Berry case, what the Court of Criminal Appeals has said that this court should review in making the determination. But I do believe that in our brief, I have set out the reasons why, in this case, we've met the test for showing that the CPS investigator was, in fact, working, ultimately working for in the interest of the state and as a conduit of the state. The officer who was present during the interview does not appear to have testified at trial. I glanced through, and I could not find his name, but I looked back through the witnesses who testified. So he did not testify. It was at the Denton County Jail in an arraignment room, as Ms. Simmons correctly stated, and that's in the record in Volume 3, 76 to 77.
But I would just simply urge that his mere presence, this officer's presence, transformed this interview, which may not have initially set out to be an interview on behalf of law enforcement. It transformed it, and it became one when the investigator elicited this statement about the facts of the charged offense.
What if the officer hadn't been present? And the questions were exactly the same. Are you going to say, take the same position?
I wouldn't have to, Your Honor, because the officer was present. That is our fact. Those are our facts. But I know you're asking me a hypothetical.
Well, you're dwelling on his presence, and I'm trying to ascertain how his mere presence affects the outcome here.
Because his presence affected the perception of my client, which is a very important piece of the puzzle of determining whether this interview was in the interest at the behest of law enforcement. So I think I don't think that's to be taken lightly that the officer was present. I think that, you know, again, that is a significant part of the analysis. If there are no further questions, we pray that this court review the record thoroughly and in its entirety, which I know this court will, and reverse and render either an acquittal based on our first issue or remand for a new trial based on our second or three-fourth issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ordaway. Ms. Simmons, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. We will adjourn for 10 minutes, then pick up with our 3 o'clock docket.
All rise.